Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Long-term unemployment is not like a couple of months without work. It eats into people and their families and their finances, of course. It also eats into the strength of the nation's labor force. Right now, long-term employment is at levels not seen since the Great Depression. 6 million people, maybe you, out of work 6 months or more. Many more long underemployed. Now, as the holidays come again, this hour On Point, we're confronting the relentless reality of the long-term jobless. You can join the conversation. Is this you, your brother, sister, father, mother, neighbor, out of work 6 months, a year, more? What's the toll? Where's the hope? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And let us know your city and state when you comment online. Joining me now from Washington is John Itzde, NPR correspondent who's covered the U.S. economy for two decades now. He played a big role in the recent NPR series on long-term unemployment and its consequences. John, it's great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
With John today are two of the people we heard in that terrific series. With us from WOSU in Columbus, Ohio, is Sheila Egan. She's a 47-year-old single mother who was a longtime pharmaceutical salesperson, six-figure income, now long gone. She was laid off more than a year ago. Sheila, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And from Napa, California, Michael Hall is with us. He's an engineer who worked with high-tech data and phone equipment. He's 50 and has been unemployed for more than 2 years now. Mike, many thanks to you for joining us as well.
Well, thank you.
We heard from you last week on NPR. It was a terrific series, and you and Sheila and others were really great in opening up your personal circumstances for the country to focus on, and clearly we need to focus on this. Any luck in the week since we heard you on the air, Mike?
Well, actually, I had an interview from someone who had heard the article on NPR, and in talks with them now, of course, they're talking with many people who are qualified for the job as well. But I guess, I'm one of the lucky ones that got some exposure from NPR.
We're glad for the exposure and hope something works out for you there. I think I understand that you've had more than 1,000 interviews since your job went away?
No, 1,000. I applied for over 1,000 jobs.
Of course, right. 1,000 applications, but even so, wow. That's a tremendous number. And of those applications, still no job?
No, I get an interview every few months or so, which typically for the jobs that I'm considered, it would take 4 or 5 interviews to land a job. They bring you in 4 or 5 times and until you make it to the final cut. I only get a nibble every few months.
We're wishing for you. We're hoping for you. Sheila, what about your circumstance? More than a year now. It's been a long time. We've heard you say that you have trouble sometimes keeping up with the industry where you made a good income. That after a certain point, just the cost of subscriptions for trade magazines and professional communications becomes hard to bear. Any luck in the week or so since we heard from you?
Actually, I had an interview just before I spoke with NPR before, and unfortunately, I didn't get a call back for that one. But that was one of a handful of interviews that I have had since last fall.
John, in Washington, when people say that these are levels we haven't seen since the Great Depression, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean the number of millions? I mean, you look at the chart, millions, you look back to January 07, it almost doesn't show up, the long-term unemployed, on a chart of American unemployment. Now it's 6.2 million or so. How does it compare with what we've seen historically, John?
I don't think they kept this exact statistic back to the Great Depression, and the numbers of workers then were much smaller because the population was much smaller. But we have more than 6 million people considered long-term unemployed right now. That means they've been out of work for 6 months or more. And like Sheila and Mike, many have been out of work much longer than that. And that is about a little more than 40% of the total number of unemployed. So it's a large chunk of the unemployed, of the 15 million people unemployed in the country. Usually that number of long-term unemployed in normal times is somewhere between, 10 and 20% of the total number of people unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in really difficult waters here, unprecedented waters, really. And we're getting close to the levels of unemployed that some European countries have faced in the past couple of decades, levels that really do eat away at your economy.
Well, what about that? What did Europeans find when they had high long-term unemployment? What were the consequences for the overall economy that we may now face, John?
Well, the basic consequence is, despite the fact that they're, technologically advanced economies like ours, they grew significantly less during that period because they had so many people, so much human capital sitting on the sidelines instead of being gainfully employed and productive.
And which is a cost to the whole economy, not just
Absolutely.
The sort of gigantic personal cost that people feel one by one. I mean, Mike, you're clearly a smart guy. You present very well. Sheila, same with you. You've been out there in the economy and done very well in the past. How do you read what's going on here, Mike? I listened to you on the NPR series. In your old job, you were presenting on digital equipment and telephones all over the country, flying everywhere, every day of the week. Sounded kind of like George Clooney in Up in the Air. And now the economy's just gone from underneath you. How do you think through what's happened here, Mike?
Well, I guess what I'm struck by the most is that, I'm certainly not alone. And there's millions, as you said, of people in the same situation or much worse. I'm single. And fortunately, I suppose, I don't have any children. But I guess what strikes me the most is, like you spoke of, this loss of capital. Or not used. It's not lost. It's just sitting there,
mm-hmm.
not being used. And I think it's certainly hurting the country overall at a time when our economy is slipping in the global race, certainly. And not finding a way to utilize this capital is a grave mistake, I believe, and we're not focusing. I say we, I guess, as a society, or maybe perhaps our government,
mm-hmm.
is not focusing on good use of all this intelligence, if you will.
Sheila, in the political season we've just been through, we heard again and again just jobs, jobs, jobs. It was a mantra, Republican, Democrat, everybody talking about jobs. Does that sort of show up, manifest itself to you in terms of things that are helpful to you? There's a lot of talk about jobs, but do you see policies that are making your job search easier in a tangible way?
No, not in a tangible way. I think the biggest thing probably is that the things that Congress has done that have been incredibly helpful is subsidizing the COBRA payments. That has been invaluable to me, and extending unemployment benefits. Those are the things that have probably helped the most as far as public policy goes. But the jobs come from private industry posting jobs, and it's not going to be solved by a government as much as corporations and private entities.
Do people around you, Sheila, understand what you're going through? I don't know, neighbors, relatives, former colleagues, do they get what it's like to be out there a year and counting without a job?
No, absolutely not. In fact, during your introduction today, mm-hmm. it was almost surreal. I was thinking, oh, my gosh, he's talking about me. I have worked since I was 14 years old. I have never been without a job. And there is an incredible stigma. In fact, people have said to me, what are you doing wrong? Let me see your resume. Your resume must be horrible. What are you saying at interviews that might be preventing you from getting a job? Very much I don't get why this has happened to you, and you must be doing something wrong to perpetuate it.
John Itstein, in your reporting, what did you find? Is there a chasm growing between those who, by luck and good work, still have jobs and those who are in this huge number of people who don't? I mean, do people really understand what's out there if they're not in that unemployed line?
Well, I don't think they do. And in fact, you have employers now who are saying they're not interested in hiring the unemployed. They want to hire someone who already has a job. So people like Mike and Sheila don't even make the first cut because they're unemployed. The resumes come in, someone sees they're unemployed, they set them aside, and a company and a hiring official looks on for someone who's already got a job. Because they, you know, there is this stigma, as Sheila says, that, that employers believe somehow if you're unemployed, it must be partly your fault. In one of my stories, we heard from a recruiter who said that people had told him they didn't want to hire unemployed people. And he made the point that, you know, the way that people think about it is somehow he said, well, you know, people don't lay off their best producers. So let's look for someone employed who's a best producer. Now, I think in this incredible crisis that we've been through, obviously lots and lots of people who are very, very talented have been laid off. And if employers aren't looking in that group of people, they're missing out on some real gems.
To be up against a terrible economy plus that is pretty rough. Mike, I know you've had that experience. We'll talk about it. Lots of feedback online here. Here's Bob who says, I was out for 11 months and people smarter than me have been out for 2+ years. It's insane. I felt like I was in hell, had daily anxiety attacks, thought about suicide. You never find out about this until you get there and you can't get out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about long-term unemployment at its worst since the Great Depression, with people who are living it right now. John Itzty's with us from NPR. They've just put on a great series looking at this problem. It cannot be forgotten. It is all around us, maybe in your family. Sheila Egan is with us from Columbus, Ohio, was a salesperson, pharmaceuticals, six-figure income, now out of work for more than a year, a 47-year-old single mother. Michael Hall is with us from Napa, California. He's applied for more than 1,000 jobs since he lost his job more than 2 years ago. 50 years old, a talented guy, and still looking for that way back in to the economy. Here's another web post from Washington State. As a 54-year-old with a bad limp, I'd like to think my age and cane are the reason I have not been able to get a permanent job in 2 years. My full resume is packed with achievement, but I edit and tailor both resume and cover letter to the advertised position. Otherwise, I'd look too experienced and expensive. She writes, a year ago, I created a list of expensive but nutritious foods, and then a list of inexpensive but nutritious foods, and then a list of luxury items that I had to give up. I put dill pickles on my luxury list, and that one decision hit me hard. If you've lived long-term unemployment, you may know what she's talking about. 800-423-TALK. Matt Youngquist joins us now from Bellevue, Washington, Washington State, an employment counselor and coach who runs a firm called Career Horizons. Matt, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You're in the biz. Are you running into long-term unemployed every time you turn around now?
There's quite a lot of it out there, as you've been discussing, and I'm just very thankful that the story is getting some attention, because I do think it's been quite underreported out there.
It's easy to say what should people do, but when it stretches into a year and 2 years and you've got the whole national economy in that circumstance, people may wonder, is there anything that an individual can do to sort of, you know, break out of that hole and get a job?
There certainly are some things. There's no magic bullets. I think anyone suggesting there are or trying to sell you some, you should run away. But there's definitely some strategies and things that a lot of people can do that will give them the best fighting chance out there, for sure.
Give us a couple of examples, Matt.
Well, I always look at it as, if there's one asset that unemployed folks have in spades, it's time. And I always, when I sit down, look at how are they investing these 8 or 10 hours of time a day that they would typically be working. And a mix of things, you know, job hunting in certain ways is a big part of that, but other things as far as skill development, continuing education, relationship building, and just being healthy, putting some plans in place to be at their best, not their worst. I don't think a lot of people talk about that issue of things.
Mike, you know, what do you think when you hear kind of advice that comes from career counselors these days? With 1,000 applications out there, you've been busy at that. I mean, is there generic advice that's helpful to you, or is it already, you know, what you know from having been so long and well in the working world?
Well, I've certainly heard and taken most of the advice that has been presented to me. The last company I worked for, when we got laid off, hired a professional firm that we had at our access for 8 weeks, saying pretty much the same things that Pat is saying, and I've certainly done all of that. But to answer your question, has it been helpful? Obviously not, is the sad answer. I do, I recommend doing all the things that Pat was talking about. One of the things I'm doing right now is pursuing my CCNA, which is the Cisco Certified Network Associate, just to keep my mind a little sharper, and also something else, another certification to have on the resume. I also recommend exercising and keeping healthy, especially for us older applicants. You want to be as spry and youthful and full of vigor as you possibly can when if you do get that face-to-face. But also networking. All of my really good opportunities really have come through basically through former colleagues or contacts with customers. When they you cut through the pile, they say, hey, look, I know this guy's quality, and this is who we want. And that's how you get to the top of the pile, is with a reference from someone the hiring manager trusts.
Right. Sheila, I know you've been out at job fairs and support groups with hundreds, maybe thousands of people. I mean, what do you sense in morale among when you're in these big groups of the unemployed? I heard you tell John Itzty and NPR, we all did, that, you know, the sort of people's determination is very high, and, you know, they're out there with a lot of positive attitude. But is that holding up as this stretches out, Sheila?
Well, I think that you have to balance everything. There were days when I would go to the job work group that I went to every Wednesday, and I would feel incredibly inspired by how determined and optimistic these people were. And other days, it would just depress me beyond belief that these people were so incredibly talented and driven and motivated, and nothing good was happening for them. So it can be a double-edged sword sometimes.
I think it was you, Sheila, saying it's hard to keep up sometimes just because of the finances, just to subscribe to the magazines you'd like to subscribe to stay on top of what's going on in your field.
Well, I think that finances in general is just a huge issue when you're unemployed for any length of time. But it is very difficult because a lot of information and research, it's the environment you're in when you're with your colleagues and they hear about something. And so now when you're removed from that situation, you aren't having that interaction with your colleagues like you used to. And so you do get a little bit rusty and removed from things.
John Itzty, what does happen with people's finances here? I mean, I think for a lot of folks who understand, you know, they see how even with a job, a lot of people are paying bills month to month. Unemployment has been there, that we'll talk about that. I mean, it may go away for some long-term unemployed at the end of this month, a vote this week against extending those benefits. But what happens to people's finances? How do they, I can imagine people who have a job saying, how on earth do they get by, John?
Well, I think it's true, and I think both Mike and Sheila have experienced this. Both of them were well-paid professionals and had money in their 401ks, had some savings, and they've had to deplete those resources significantly and depend on federal government extended unemployment. As you said, there's an effort right now to extend long-term unemployment. Once the state benefits run out, the federal government has been stepping in and paying unemployment. That runs out at the end of the month, and there's an effort to extend it. There's been one setback for that, but it's very difficult. I know that Mike told me his family has been very helpful. So it's difficult to piece together a way to make it. There's no doubt about it.
Let's go to our listeners. Lots of callers here. Tom in South Kingston, Rhode Island. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Great show. I think this is a show that's long overdue, and I really appreciate you devoting the time to it. I'm an architect, and I lost my job about 24 months ago, and I have been searching, for such an incredibly long time. My unemployment benefits finally ran out, and I decided, it's either sink or swim, so I started my own firm, which I was able to get, a certain number of projects right away, but then outside of that, things have really dried up, and I am having to, really determine if I want to continue on in architecture or change fields. I only do sustainable design. I've only done that. And so the green sector jobs people talk about are out there, but they're incredibly difficult to find. And when you do find them, just like a lot of your callers and a lot of the guests have talked about, you go through the interview process, and by the time, you know, you might have one interview, and then 3 or 4 weeks may go by, and at that point you've written it off. But if you're lucky, you'll get a second, you know, interview and go in, and then sometimes you never know what happens.
So, Tom, you've given thought to even changing careers after 24 months without a job.
I mean, I have, and that's after a substantial investment in education, in going through a number of different things. And, you know, I don't know, people talk about architecture as the canary in the coal mine, mm-hmm. but back when it was in its heyday before the recession, there were about 250,000 architects employed. Recently, the figure has come out that has now dropped to about 165,000.
Wow.
So if you look at that, and then the AIA projects that over the next 10 years there will be a 10% growth, well, what's happened to all of those other people? Much less those people coming out.
But how do you go through the math, Tom? How do you work through the math of thinking about a career change? You invested in a big way in your profession, architecture. I mean, can you afford to invest again to get up to a comparable level of expertise in some other field?
Well, that's just it. When I left, I was the sole income for the family, and when I lost my job, and now, you know, through unemployment and then through a lot of support from family members, and then the jobs that I can find, I have, you know, pieced it together, but I've also really depleted my own personal savings. And so, you know, it's sort of, you feel a little bit like Sisyphus rolling the stone up the hill, and is this really worth it, given, you know, that the green sector jobs really are going to road construction, a number of other areas, but really not into architecture. And so I understand sustainable and green design. I'm very skilled in that. So I've looked at doing green jobs in terms of being a sustainable director for not-for-profit organizations.
Let me ask you, Tom, if I may, though. I've got, like, for example, here online, and we've got a lot of people writing in with their unemployment stories, you know, over a year without a job, 15 months, 27 months, 20 months. But here's an email from Janet in Tennessee, and it says, there are help wanted signs everywhere here. McDonald's, Bed Bath & Beyond, the auto inspection station, just to name three I saw yesterday. Unemployed people feel like they can't afford to work for minimum wage, but isn't working for minimum wage better than not working at all? What do you say to that kind of argument, Tom, with 2 years of unemployment behind you?
Well, I mean, you know, there's an argument to say, yep, a job is a job, and I certainly understand that. But at the same time, one of your callers said, well, what are you doing with that 8 or 10 hours of your day, because you have time mm-hmm. as a commodity? And so, you know, I'm on a number of different boards for organizations. I've been networking. And, you know, finding a job is a full-time job to try to find a job. And so when you're doing something like that, if you are at the point where you have to have that minimum wage job, then you're losing out on the ability potentially to find a higher paying job.
Yeah, of course. That's a very tough trade-off. Tom, we have so many callers here. I appreciate yours very much, and good luck to you. One more right here from Lexington, Kentucky. Donna. Donna, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. I have so many things I'd like to say, and I'm sure you don't have most of them, but one of the main things that I'd like to say is this networking is so important. And I think that other people could be doing a lot to help the unemployed network. For instance, we can't afford to maintain the memberships in organizations that we used to be able to work with. And I think people could offer free memberships. For instance, the Chamber of Commerce, what would it cost them to offer a short-term membership to somebody mm-hmm. who's unemployed, mm-hmm. just so that they could go to the meetings and network and do that sort of thing? I can't imagine how it could cost them anything. I understand that at a lot of the meetings there's a lunch or a breakfast served, but guess what? Put a chair around the, put chairs around the perimeter of the room, and most of us who need to sit in the peanut gallery will.
Donna, you know, that is a fantastic idea, but let me ask you, I mean, how do you think those people would feel, those with jobs in the middle of the room, surrounded by the cloud that is actually out there in life, but people may not see every day, of unemployed? I mean, could they deal with it?
Well, you know what? They could look at it and say, oh, my God, look at this talent pool.
Yeah.
Look at these people. I need somebody. And, you know, not every job is advertised.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are advertised aren't advertised well. And you might guess my background is marketing and public relations. And
mm-hmm.
this is one of the ways I see to solve a problem. It's a no-cost, low-cost way to help people that could be implemented immediately if anybody had thought of it.
I love the instinct. Professional organizations, make it free, bring in people without jobs, let them be right there. Matt Youngquist, there's a couple of things on the table. First, our caller who says, what about a career change? He's invested a lot in being an architect. What do you say to people who are considering a complete career change, Matt, in order to find employment again?
Yeah, those are always really tough decisions. I mean, in the short term, a career change takes an awful lot of time and energy and retraining, and often, you know, doesn't solve the problem as quickly as people hope. At the same time, if someone is in a career that just doesn't seem viable, or all the tea leaves say, you know, for the next couple of years may not be, you know, lots of positions running around, I mean, it is an option. I still find the majority of people, when they do the analysis, should buckle down and concentrate more on marketing themselves more diligently and creatively. And I certainly don't mean to suggest, the specific callers on here and guests may not be in that camp, but a lot of people, I think, before they consider the nuclear option of a career change, need to really ask themselves, you know, how much outbound marketing, how creative, how diligent have they been? And I hear a lot of emphasis on resumes and applications, which sort of triggers something that leads me to think more of the caller who said networking relationships. I mean, that's 60-70% of jobs are unadvertised, so I hope people are putting enough time in those channels too.
And Mike, Sheila, first to you, what about your old colleagues or maybe professional organizations? Donna's saying, let them open their doors and bring in the unemployed to sit with them. Maybe things will show up there. Do you feel a welcome mat still out, Sheila, among your old colleagues or people in that line of work? Or, you know, are they, say, I don't know, turning away?
I have tried to keep in touch with as many people as possible and reconnect with as many people as possible just to keep my networking options open.
Mm-hmm.
There are two sides to that as well. There are people who, and sometimes the very same person, when they find out about a job, they will be calling you all excited and telling you to get your resume in as soon as possible. And then when you're just talking with them in general, you can sense that there's a guilt, that they feel kind of bad, that they're complaining to you about how miserable they are in their six-figure
right,
job
right.
when you're sitting there saying, oh, yes, I feel so sorry for you.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Mike,
yeah.
do you feel old colleagues, Mike, or professional acquaintances turning toward you or away?
Well, I keep in touch with as many as I can. And some have been helpful with leads or an understanding of the market and where it's going in my specific field. However, it's pretty much going downhill is the problem. Engineering is it's probably second only to construction as far as not being a good field to be in. But however, touching on an earlier point, I myself have applied for jobs washing cars, mowing lawns, tending bar, shoveling manure, I mean, you name it.
Wow.
And haven't had a call on any of them. And so that's kind of an insult when people ask you, well, why don't you, I see a help wanted sign, to assume that you haven't applied for it already is kind of an insult.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about long-term unemployment at its worst now since the Great Depression, with people who are living it right now. John Itzi is with us with NPR. They did a great series on the labor that is being, not employed at this point, what it costs individuals and what it costs this country. He joins us from Washington. Matt Youngquist is with us from Bellevue, Washington State. He's an employment counselor there with Career Horizons, has dealt with lots of people in this circumstance. Sheila Egan's here from Columbus, Ohio, 47 years old, single mother, was a pharmaceutical salesperson, doing quite well, out of work now for more than a year. And Mike Hall's with us from California, systems engineer, was all over the country with that work until 2 years ago, and it's been a tough slog since then. John Itzi and Matt, here's a web post from DH. He says, I've been unemployed or underemployed for 16 months. I've applied for roughly 200 jobs, and I'm wondering if I haven't tried hard enough. It's difficult to communicate the frustration, the humiliation, the helplessness, the fear that's just become part of my life. When I was laid off in July 2009, I thought I would definitely be working by January. I've been turned down for jobs I would have never imagined applying for. Call center employee, civil service, entry-level position, package handler at UPS. Anyway, D.H. writes, and he was a journalist, I have lost hope. I literally cannot imagine getting another full-time job that paid me decently. I mean, John, is that the kind of story you heard out there? That you see the psychological trauma there as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's clear that this is taking a huge toll on people emotionally and psychologically in terms of their self-image. And it's hard for people to go forward. And the problem is it's hard to see hope in the economy itself. I mean, the real solution here is a growing economy. But our economy, even though it's growing, is not growing fast enough to bring the unemployment rate down. You need to have annual growth of 3% in the economy just to keep the unemployment rate steady. And we've been growing for the last 18 months or so at most, 2.9% on average. So it's disheartening for people. And one of the things that that Sheila told me, actually, that I think is a good idea for people is if they have some of this time, that they look to volunteer in one way or another, either at a nonprofit or at a business. Sheila can tell us about her sister's business where she volunteered to help out and had that experience of, being in a workplace and not having a hole in her resume. She could say, I was doing this during that period of time.
So. Sheila, is that what it does for you? Simply, give some evidence of active engagement with society to volunteer? It doesn't bring you money.
Well, it doesn't, and it can also detract from searching for a job that does pay money. But I think it's important for a couple of reasons. It gives you structure and gives you a goal and something to think about besides yourself and your own situation. But there's nothing that says everything that appears on your resume has to be a paid position. And it's very important to me to not have that hole in my resume. I think that is just would be so detrimental at this point. I'm already questioned about why it's a different area than my experience is in. So it kind of raises red flags anyway because it's a departure from my career path. But still, no, it's there, and I am able to say that I'm doing something.
Let's get a call from Kansas City. Sarah, you're on the air, Sarah. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a point that there isn't the normal movement in the job market because people are paralyzed. So the people with jobs won't change, won't try for a promotion because they're afraid they might get fired, like if they move from union to management.
Right.
People are driving 50 or 100 miles to get a job. And then there's that commute time and the gas they have to spend. New moms won't enter the workforce after they have their babies because there's no jobs. So there's no natural movement. So all the people who are unemployed, they're just running into a brick wall.
I might add, one of the stories that we did in our series was about people not being able to move because of the housing crisis. Their homes are underwater. They can't sell their homes, so they can't go to a place where they might believe there's a job available. Or even if they're offered a job, they have a hard time, leaving that house and taking that huge financial hit.
Matt Youngquist, do you see this dynamic of people who do have jobs being kind of afraid to move around, just sort of sitting pat because of, as Sarah puts it, a paralysis, a fear of doing anything that might put them into the, near the unemployment line?
Certainly that's out there. I mean, that's contributing to things, and a lot of people are hunkered down just kind of riding the storm out. And I would also heartily agree with what John said. I think that the root of this whole problem is the lack of a growing economy and new jobs being added in any numbers, and that right now you've just got a ferocious game of musical chairs going on out there where, again, all the folks on this call are just having to compete best they can. I would inject the positive note that having worked with a lot of people who have been out 1, 2, and 3 years, it just takes one. And I've had people fight through this year or two, be as resilient as they can, and then, you know, the stars align, they get that position, and they, you know, it's back to where they want to be. So it does happen for folks, but yeah, it's an awfully tough process.
Mike Hall, you're listening there in California. We've got a lot of people writing in about the issue of age and unemployment. And these are ages that are not that high. People who are, you know, just in their early 50s saying that they're feeling a bias against them because they're not in their 40s or 30s or 20s. You talked with John about having experienced that. I mean, and I was struck by how when you talked with John, you don't sound like an old guy at all, and you're not. You're 50. But even at that age, you've really run up against an issue of age, Mike, in your job search?
Well, typically it's over 40 that that's the bias is considered old. But at 50, yes, absolutely. One of the things that's been suggested to me is changing one digit in the year I graduated, adding 10 years to it, and then removing the first 10 years of my experience, and omitting that so I could say, well, it was a keystroke, but making it appear that I'm 10 years younger than I am. And that goes against my my grain to do something that would be dishonest. However, it's certainly no less dishonest than many corporations are. Their practices.
Yeah, I mean,
yes, absolutely. I do run into that.
John, it seemed in your reporting, you came straight up against it. People saying straight out that they were not looking to hire folks who'd been out of work too long, or I guess they can't legally say it, but there's a kind of ageism that comes right along with that sometimes.
Yeah, yes, there is. It certainly is. And obviously, the age is a protected thing, but it's very difficult to prove that you didn't get a job because of your age. And, you know, there is some question about the legality of saying we don't want – no one need apply if they're unemployed because I was talking to someone from the National Employment Law Project who was saying – pointing out that a high ratio – minorities have a higher ratio of unemployment than
the general number, I guess.
Than the general population.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are discriminating against the unemployed, you could make a case that you're discriminating against a protected class of people. So there is, you know, there is some gray area there that corporations might want to think about if they are saying they don't want to hire the unemployed.
Matt Youngquist, what does a person do about that? I mean, our date of birth is our date of birth. You know, you can hear Mike. It might be tempting to have just a keystroke error there that knocked 10 years off. I mean, how do you suggest people get around this issue of age and reluctance?
Yeah, that's awfully tough. I mean, I see a lot of suggestions of people to dumb their resume down, so to speak. To me, I'm pretty reluctant to suggest people do that, one, the integrity issue, and even if it could help in some small degree get you another interview or two, I just think to already have that strike against you, have that credibility gap, I'm pretty reluctant to recommend that. I think it just puts people on the defensive, and if we go down that route, we've got bigger problems. So only in a dire crisis would I suggest fast and loose with the facts on a resume.
2 years starts to sound like a dire crisis. Patrick in Ayer, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
It's been a great show. And like another caller said, long overdue, so I appreciate you taking your time this morning to bring this up.
What's your story, Patrick?
I called you last year on another show. I was laid off in February of 2009 and was in the process of looking for another career. And during the time that I had spoke with you, I was actually looking into biotechnology. It's fairly strong in eastern Massachusetts. And I went back to college and am close to should be getting the degree in December. But as part of the program, I was able to get an internship at a local biotechnology manufacturing facility and should have a full-time benefited position in December. So,
wow, congratulations. That's great.
Yeah, it worked out well for me. I was very lucky, worked very hard, but I also was very lucky because there are a lot of other people who were in those classes with me that didn't get the position. So,
Patrick, how bare did the cupboard get before you found what we hope will be that job?
Well, we lost some things. We lost an automobile. We lost some family heirlooms. We lost savings. For me, the opportunity to go back to college, I think, saved my life in a lot of ways, because having a goal to look at and having a and try to reach that to the best of your ability kept my mind sharp and kept me mentally in the game. And there's no doubt that going back to school was the right decision for me. And we lost a lot of things, but along the way, I also learned a lot about myself, a lot about my resilience, and a lot about what I can do when, you know, backed into a corner.
Patrick, I hope that job comes through for you right on schedule and solid, and we're very happy for the news that you've got it, and I appreciate your call. Let's get one more. Jeff in Rutland, Vermont. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. Probably my comments are going to irk a couple of your guests there, but my wife, we have a small family, two kids.
Yep.
My wife was a teacher for over 20 years. She got tenure and then got laid off, and it's almost impossible for her to get a job again because they have to pay her so much. But she was willing, because she had to support the family. Instead of using up tons of unemployment, she went out and found a job as a waitress. It is definitely beneath her, and it's a lot less money, but she's willing to go out there and work. And one of your guests there commented about, well, she can hardly afford subscriptions. Well, we could hardly afford subscriptions. We were both working, and now she's got this lesser job. And I think that's a luxury, and I think a lot of the people out there, not all of them, but a lot of them just won't take jobs because they say it's beneath them. And I just don't think that's right to us that are working and paying unemployment taxes on our salary we are getting. And again, if my wife, after 20 years of teaching, was willing to take a waitress job, I don't see why a lot of other people won't take these other jobs.
Jeff, I hear your passion on it. I mean, and you know, definitely people need to make a living. But if that happens to the whole country, I mean, should we all just step down and maybe so, Jeff? Is that what you're saying? Like, just do whatever it takes and we'll have a new American profile?
And take whatever job you can and start working yourself back up again. I know it's hard. And again, we're going through it in our family, but these people are complaining she doesn't get her subscriptions. She's a single mother. Well, again, we didn't put her in that circumstance. And those are my comments. But
Jeff, I appreciate your call. Sheila, what do you say to that kind of outlook? My wife's working as a waitress. She was a teacher. You can waitress too.
Well, and I have waitressed, as a matter of fact, and I have applied for jobs that were probably 30% of my old salary. I have applied for a number of jobs that are far less than half of what I used to make, and either never heard back or someone younger was chosen, because I think that a lot of times they feel that if they are hiring someone who used to make a larger salary, that the person probably won't stay very long. So there is a bit of, I hate a bias when someone is obviously overqualified for a job and comes in to apply for it. I don't know if the hiring manager thinks it looks desperate or thinks that the person will leave as soon as they get a chance, but it doesn't always work out very well, because I've applied for a lot of jobs that were not lucrative at all.
Yeah. Matt Youngquist, what do you say to clients when they're wrestling with us, you know, should I hang in there and look for the job that will maybe be something like the job I've had and its income, or go for something where the income may be a lot less? How do you advise people, Matt?
Well, I think the truth on that one's somewhere in the middle. I think, as Sheila just said, it is far harder than most people would guess to take or find a job that's quote-unquote beneath you, because of the overqualified stigma, the amount of high school kids and other people that are also, you know, looking for those jobs. So you can't just fall back necessarily to something like that. At the same time, as your caller pointed out, I do think there's a number of folks who don't take jobs that are available just because it's not to the level they're used to. And study after study shows that when unemployment benefits run out, whether in the U.S. or other countries, suddenly a ton of people get back to work somehow. So I think there is some truth in the middle there. It's a pretty individual case, but it is definitely not as easy for most people to just take a waitress job or something, because there's plenty of other folks competing for those as well.
John, it's a personal burden to be unemployed for this long, and as you say, often a family burden as people reach out to support relatives. But what does it mean for the country long term when teachers become waitresses and architects become, I don't know, bricklayers, with respect for bricklayers? But, you know, if that happens on a large scale, what does it mean for the nation?
Well, you think about it. If our previous caller, Tom, who was the architect, leaves that behind, he's leaving a huge amount of of capital. I mean, it's like leaving money on the table, walking away from it, not employing it in the economy anymore, and trying to find another job. In a well-functioning economy, if you're an auto worker and those jobs go away and you become a skilled nurse or go to an area where, you know, that needs workers, that's one thing. That can be very good for the economy. But in this economy, we have so many people, so many of them skilled, who have those skills set on the sideline, that it's like putting piles of money on the sideline in a capitalistic society and not investing it. And, you know, it's just really hard on the economy, and it's part of the reason that we're continuing to grow slowly.
Hard on the economy, hard on the people who are in the middle of it. Holidays coming now, and that's going to be a hard time of year. For everyone who's called in today and written in today, you know, we're feeling your pain here today. It's too easy to look away among those who have jobs. And for all of those who've written in and are with us today as well, we wish very good luck. And we've got to all keep thinking together about how to make this economy one that picks people up and gives them work. Michael Hall in California. Michael, thank you so much for being with us, and good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Sheila Egan in Ohio, Columbus. Thanks for being with us, Sheila, and good luck to you as well.
Thank you.
Matt Youngquist and John Itzde with NPR. Thanks to you both. It's been great to have you. Listeners, thanks for all your comments. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.